Just across the East River from the Upper East Side of Manhattan, Ward's Island is a drab gray strip of city land, the sort of place even lifelong New Yorkers may never notice. Its skyline consists simply of three institutional high-rise brick buildings, one next to the other. Two of these buildings are identical. They are state psychiatric hospitals serving patients from Manhattan. The third looks the same as the first two, except this building is surrounded by two high fences topped with loops of razor wire. There are imposing light towers mounted with video monitors, a high-tech microwave security system. This is the Kirby Forensic Psychiatric Center.
On the gate! On the gate! Simple.
Visiting Kirby is like visiting any prison. To get inside, it's past security officers and two-way mirrors, through metal detectors and prison gates. But the simple and disturbing ground rules that must be followed here make it clear that this place is different from anywhere else. Don't wear anything around your neck that you can be strangled with. Don't turn your back on a patient or shake a patient's hand. Never tell a patient anything about your personal life. With all this in mind, I was given permission by the hospital to spend several days unaccompanied on one of the wards at Kirby, Ward 2 West, home to 23 men who have been found not guilty by reason of insanity. I arrived on the ward on a rainy Tuesday afternoon. It was lunchtime. The men were eating in the small, sterile dining room at the front of the ward, sitting at half a dozen tables, their chairs bolted to the floor. Trays of food were slid to them from underneath an iron-barred window. Three large security staffers in blue jeans and T-shirts stood at the corners of the room, their arms folded, watching the men eat.
Anybody want some fruit cocktail free?
Is it poison?
No, it isn't poison, but it's poison to
me. How long have you been sitting on your tray?
It just was given me.
Just given you? I'm going to get you a cigarette. What place is this?
This is Kirby
Forensic Psychiatric Center for Psychopathic Maniac Killers, State of Massacres and Drug...
That's called Done in Badfield. That's called Done in Badfield, all right?
I had been told a little bit about a few of the 23 patients here, those who had committed some of the more gruesome and notorious crimes, but I didn't know yet who was who. At the end of the meal, as the patients filed to the front of the dining room to turn in their plastic utensils, each fork and knife carefully checked in and counted by a staff member, they began to introduce themselves.
Hello, I'm a mental patient at the Kirby Psychiatric Center, and I'd like to say hello to my man Charles Manson and all the Hells Angels International chapter. Signing out. Peace.
My name is Uncle Sam. I am Internal Revenue Service Special Agent, and I want you to buy U.S. savings bonds. $25 will get you a $1,000 increase in 7 years to help stop inflation and depression and our boys from going overseas. My name is Uncle Sam.
Sam, take me away, where I'm going.
Some of the patients heading out of the dining room this afternoon seem as if they might be mentally retarded. Some look drugged up. Others seem clear-eyed, nodding and smiling as they pass by, not saying much. A short Asian man with hunched shoulders and rotting yellow teeth plants himself in front of me and stares. I'm told by another patient that he hasn't spoken for years. He can only laugh. As the patients make their way to the dormitories at the back of the ward for their daily after-lunch nap, a huge man with two nose rings and a T-shirt that reads, "Kill 'em all," motions me over.
I think I'm the person you should be talking to, because I've been here 16 years straight.
This is Muhammad, president of Ward 2 West. He was elected by the other patients. In the 1970s, he threw a woman in front of a speeding subway. He's lived here ever since. Muhammad volunteers to show me around the ward, which is cleaner and brighter than I had expected. Except for a securely locked front door, it could be any ward in any modern state institution. He takes me back to the ward's large open dormitory, where most of the patients are napping.
You see that man there on the bed down there? Take this from, look at him from a distance. What do you see?
I see feet.
I mean, look at the man, look at him. Looks like a dead corpse there in there. Another dead corpse. Another day. Another day. Another day.
Nothing.
Muhammad walks me over to his area, sits me down, and tells me he's under special watch for trying to murder three patients recently. He says he's a gentle person, except under certain circumstances.
Pushed into a situation that I can't handle any other way, I will retaliate with either mayhem or murder. And this is with full, clear, and conscious intent to do such.
A little later, something strange occurs. A doctor had mentioned that Muhammad's facial expressions have an odd way of changing without warning. And in the middle of our conversation, this happens. I look up to see that his generally placid expression has suddenly transformed into a murderous glare, unlike anything I had ever seen before. He is furiously biting his lip, slowly rocking back and forth. He seems poised to attack. That's when I notice that Muhammad and I are alone, completely out of sight of the security staff. Silently, our eyes locked, I get up and very slowly walk away. That night, as a hospital doctor had predicted, I alternate between nightmares and sleeplessness.
Okay, I'll play the Nazi national anthem for you. You know what that is?
Da, 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 that one.
Yeah.
There are 150 patients housed on six identical wards at Kirby. Five of these are for men and one is for women. About two-thirds of the patients at the hospital are here because they've been found incompetent to stand trial. It's the hospital's job to treat them until they are well enough to participate in their criminal cases. There are 50 patients, including those on Ward 2 West, who have gone through their trials and been found not guilty by reason of insanity, which means that because of their mental state at the time of their crime, they either did not understand what they were doing or were incapable of understanding that what they were doing was wrong.
It was in March the 3rd, 1979, when I thought myself to be a federal police officer.
Melvin, who is 41 years old, looks like an enormous child. His pot belly hangs out from a too short t-shirt. He wears a baseball cap and Coke bottle glasses held together with masking tape.
One day I was going out to look for crime, and I didn't see any crime. I would hear the sirens of the police cars going to the different scenes, but I didn't see any crime. So as I was going home, walking home about three blocks from where I lived, I saw a man walking with a 16-year-old boy up the street. So I pulled out my gun, and that's when I fired and shot him. And he collapsed out in the street.
Once committed to Kirby, patients are kept here for an indefinite period until it's determined that they no longer pose any sort of a threat to society or themselves. The release process is long and arduous. Some patients never get out. Dennis Wojcik is a legal services attorney who represents patients here.
My impression is that people think the insanity plea is a cop-out, a way for some criminal perpetrator to get over and get away with something. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, what happens is people do a far greater time overall in a maximum security mental hospital than they would ever do in prison.
Look, miscarriage, bleach, technical burden, statute of limitations, lenient, due process of lawful misdemeanor, 9.5 months.
There's not much variety from one day to the next for the patients on 2 West. They spend the vast majority of their time in one of two rooms on the ward, the smoking room or the day room. The day room is the larger and more cheerful of the rooms. Posters of raccoons and bears and cats hang on the walls. Patients sleep or watch TV, talk to themselves or each other. At the center of the room, Alphonse, a heavy-set old Italian man in a tattered cap, sits with a world almanac and a pad, meticulously writing out the names of the countries in the European Economic Community over and over again. Another older man, Nicholas, who is Greek, paces a room, scratching his gray beard, talking endlessly to anyone who will listen about the evils of taking prayers out of the schools.
Pray the school away. They don't have to talk too much. Just say thank you, and with your help, we proceed. That's all.
Nicholas's crime? Ripping crucifixes from women's ears.
They had no business to take the the prey out. No business whatsoever.
While a whole spectrum of crimes have been committed by the men in this room, from misdemeanors to multiple murders, all of the crimes are bizarre, and the majority of them are gruesome.
I had read something once that if you decapitate a person's head, that they go to hell. So that's where I thought he belonged, in hell.
According to Dr. Jillian West, a forensics expert and psychologist who has worked at Kirby for the past 4 years, the gorier acts were often committed by those least aware of what they were doing. And later, many experienced deep remorse. Evil, she says, is a word that almost never applies here.
With all of these patients here, every single one of them, there's something good there that I can hook into and I can relate to and develop a relationship with. Even though sometimes you can think, oh, my Lord, you know, when you hear them.
Roger, a heavy-set man with slightly crossed eyes, a green felt leprechaun hat on his head, pulled his grandmother's eyes out, one of them with a fork, the other with his fingers.
When I pulled her eyes out, I wasn't trying to kill her. I was trying to stop her from killing herself. She was an alcoholic, you know, and she was overweight. And she never understood that. By drinking and smoking cigarettes, she was killing herself.
Do you consider yourself mentally ill?
No.
There seem to be two constants to life on Ward 2 West. One of these is violence. The state considers the staffers who work on the ward to hold the single most dangerous job in New York, with the highest injury rate of any profession. The other constant on the ward is noise. It's there morning to night, and there's nowhere to go to escape it, although there is one patient who seems to have adapted to it quite well. His name is Peter, and you can always find him at the front of the day room, hunched over a table, peacefully drawing, with yellow plugs stuffed deep into his ears. He's about 50 years old, has curly brown hair and a graying beard, gentle eyes behind thick glasses. Before committing his crime, Peter was a successful commercial artist. Today, he's working on a still life with pastels.
I'm drawing a banana and a fig on a plate, all on a table.
Is there a name for this?
A working title would be, "Exactly What Is It?" !!
I like it. Why?
If I were going to say why, I'd write a book. That's why I draw pictures.
For the first several days, Peter would not talk about his crime, preferring to speak of museums and music, the volumes of books he's read in the 13 years that he's been locked up, the things that he misses.
I haven't soaked in a bath, a tub of water, a hot tub of water. That's what I miss. And of course, quiet and peace, privacy.
After about 4 days, Peter was ready to talk about his crime. 13 years ago, Peter tried to murder his girlfriend. Like most of the other patients at the hospital, he says he was delusional when he committed his crime.
I imagine that there was an assassin behind the door, right behind the door where we were, who had a gun, and if I didn't do what was expected for me to do, that assassin would come through the door and kill me. That was the imaginary fear that I acted upon.
Peter slashed his girlfriend's throat with a razor blade. She lived, he tells me, and has since married and had children. They are still friends. He says that the recovery from his mental illness has been long and difficult, torturous at times. It's only over the past year or so that he's begun to feel well again. Most of the other patients on the ward, however, are not so lucky. Across the day room from Peter, Jack Brown stands for hours at a drinking fountain, his finger on the button, his head tilted in amazement as he watches the arc of the water.
Hi.
What are you doing?
Huh?
What are you doing?
Testing the water. Well, sometimes it's blood, right? Yeah.
Jack, who always has a deeply concerned look on his face, is on Ward 2 West for murdering a stranger, slashing his neck with a broken bottle. He says that the voices which commanded him to do that have yet to go away.
I talk to them all the time. Murray, Bill, they're gods. They're not the government, you know? They love me, they protect me. They love to play with me.
When was the last time you heard a voice?
just before I started talking to you.
What did the voice tell you?
I don't want to discuss that, you know.
Jack does tell me that he's been haunted by strange visions and voices now for more than 15 years.
I've seen a man walking down the street with no stomach. This was missing, my midsection. And I also seen a pair of shoes walking down the street, right? You ever seen any of these things? No? You're lucky. You're very lucky.
That must be very difficult to live with.
Enough to frighten you to death. That's why I want to die now, you know? Because I'm tired, man, you know?
I am Master Farah Mohammed, and I came to North America on my own, as my uncle lives here, and he cannot speak my language, and does not know he is my uncle. And he loves the devil because he gives him nothing, and he fears the devil because he put fear in him ever since he was a little boy, and fears him now that he is a grown man.
While just about all of the patients on the ward clearly do seem to suffer from one sort of serious mental illness or another, there are a very few patients who appear to be in no way ill, dressed impeccably, hair neatly combed. When you speak with them, they are smart, eloquent, and rather charming. After a little while, though, it becomes clear why they're here. They are unable to feel anything. They are sociopathic. Again, forensics expert and psychologist, Dr. Gillian West.
They're incapable of actually putting themselves in their victim's or their victim's family's shoes. They don't understand how that person suffered. They can't kind of experience it. And they're very wrapped up in their own feelings and to how it's inconvenienced them.
Like this patient, who one day decided to shoot his parents. He murdered his mother and crippled his father.
I'm quick to say, it's something that has happened. Regrettably, it has happened, but I just can't constantly wallop in self-pity. I can't do that. Life goes on, you know.
Then there's Alfred, who committed what might well be the most notorious of all of the crimes in the hospital. He is a mass murderer who machine-gunned an office full of people many years ago. He says he can remember every detail of the crime.
Did you ever see this picture, Halloween? You saw that picture? When I saw that picture, I was wondering how that director got that shot, because that's the way I felt. I just felt like a set of eyes. I felt like the person that is me, the real me, was pushed back and was just an observer. But my body was more or less doing what it wanted to do. I was just more like a witness of these things that was happening. It was like watching a movie from inside of my body. And when I saw that picture, I said, I don't see how this director ever got this, because that's exactly how I felt, only like I was a set of eyes. The rest of me was like gone.
Alfred says he has a difficult time feeling any remorse for the murders he committed. He spends his days on the ward exercising or meditating or doing yoga, wearing a sweatsuit with the hood pulled over his head. There's something odd about Alfred's face. When he speaks, his mouth moves, but everything else remains completely still, like a statue. He is the only patient I meet who strikes me as spooky, the way I had originally imagined the patients might be. He is also the only patient who says he objects to these sorts of stereotypes about the criminally insane.
It's just like sitting in here with you. I'm here with you by yourself. You don't look like you're terrified or scared of me. Or like if I was really anything like these people in the movie, I could jump on you and bite your face too, right? But I'm not doing that. And you don't seem to be at all nervous. You know what I mean?
Actually, I was terrified. There are breaks to the days on 2 West. Some days the patients receive counseling from the psychologist, psychiatrist, and social worker on the ward. Some days the ward is brought up to the hospital's activity floor for a couple of hours, where they can take classes or read in the library or play ping pong. The patients are also taken outside to the hospital's large fenced-in yard. Most patients pull red plastic chairs up to the fence, sit, and quietly look out. A number gather around a patient named Dwayne, who spends his yard time singing songs which he has written.
You're always on the run. There's a reason while we're here. So when the day is done.
If there's one theme which seems to run through the lives of all of the patients at Kirby, it's a history of abuse. About 90% of the patients here were victims of very serious physical or sexual abuse as children, like Jan, who owns a guitar, which his friend Dwayne is now playing. Jan is an extremely quiet, dazed-looking 26-year-old Polish emigre who always dresses in black. Throughout his childhood, Jan's father beat and tortured him.
Sometimes he'd come over to me and he'd take me by the, like, when I was be sleeping, he'd wake me up by taking me by the hair and banging my head against the wall, you know. Other times he hit me in the head. He hit me in the head with a frying pan.
7 years ago, Jan murdered his father by tearing his face off.
I have dreams about it sometimes. I dreamed I see my father all sewn up.
People's minds do not get that bent unless they've had things happen to them.
Again, legal services attorney Dennis Wojcik.
Grisly things. Unimaginable things. It's like a nightmare. This is perhaps one of the saddest places in America.
How could I ever change? How could I ever change? Leaving it all behind.
Evenings on Ward 2 West are very much like the days, with the men split up into either the smoking room or the day room, sitting where they always sit, doing what they always do, although you are likely to find that Peter, the artist, has stopped drawing in favor of a game of Scrabble with one of the security staff. Peter always wins.
This is one of those cheap words that gets a lot of points. 4, 8, 6, no, not that many points, 16, 23.
See, I'm a glutton for punishment. He's always beating me by these unbelievable amounts.
60-40 this game, you know. 60 luck and 40 skill.
Of all of the patients at the hospital, the one I ended up getting closest to was probably Muhammad, who had scared me so badly on my first day with his cold killer stare. He later told me not to take his frightening facial expressions personally. They were due, he said, to the drugs he was on. I had also heard from some staff members about Muhammad's childhood. With some degree of regularity, his parents used to cook the family's pets and then force Muhammad to eat them. At dinner, on my last evening on Ward 2 West, I had mentioned to Muhammad that I was Jewish, and after dinner, as I was watching Scrabble in the day room, in walked enormous Muhammad, nose rings and all, with a tattered Jewish prayer shawl around his shoulders and a yarmulke on his head. He sat down solemnly, motioned me over. He had something to tell me.
Enter was the best movie I have ever saw. It was touching. It was really touching to see Yentl. And Barbara Streisand, she's an expert actress. And
so Yentl's your favorite movie of all time?
Yeah, it's my all-time favorite.
Well, shalom.
Shalom.
I left the ward on that last evening in the hospital, feeling sorry for the 23 men on 2 West, and for the most part, feeling grateful that they are kept behind a securely locked door. For National Public Radio, I'm David Isay.
My name is Uncle Sam, and I got a letter for an 18-year-old boy or girl, draft plan till 36 years, over here, and dear, say a prayer for Uncle Sam.
I said,
you like that?